Welcome to Finding Flow, where your hosts George Rushen and John Honeycutt guide you on topics related to finding and achieving the optimal state of human consciousness known as flow state. They will share principles of neuroscience and peak performance, offering practical takeaways and actionable challenges to support you in finding your flow.
Hey everyone, welcome to Finding Flow, episode 5. We've come so far, John. We're going to talk about sleep today, which is perfect because it's about 5:30 in the morning my time. So when I might normally be asleep, but I'm not. I'm here. So how are you, John? You've been up a little longer than I have.
I was up since about 4 o'clock my time. Just super excited to get started with the day, and I'm doing great. If we keep doing these podcasts like this, it's going to turn into a habit. It's like I'm kind of used to seeing you at this time each week now.
Yeah. It's a good thing. And a good flex on your waking up early. That's a good, really, you're showing off. So like I mentioned, we want to talk about sleep today. We want to talk about some of the mythology around sleep. I think that's where we're going to start. And then we're going to dive into some more rigorous study around sleep, and then we're going to talk about some things that everybody can do to get better at it. But I think we'll start with the mythology, John. I know you earmarked some things that we wanted to start with there, and then we'll get into kind of the importance of sleep, and then we'll get into some practical stuff.
Yeah, beautiful. This is such an important topic for people who are looking for peak performance and flow. I would say if you have to boil the entire world of peak performance and flow down to one thing, it would be if you're not getting sleep, if you're not getting adequate sleep and you're not well rested, if you are sleep deprived, you're not going to peak perform and you're not going to get into flow state. So this is a fundamental conversation. In terms of the mythology about sleep, I just wanted to share some of the anecdotes that maybe you and I both have from our life of what we've heard that's influenced our kind of cultural stories about sleep. And I remember for myself, I went into the military when I was pretty young. I was 16 years old and went into boot camp. And when I was in my second year of military training, what's called A school in Cape May, New Jersey, I was in the U.S. Coast Guard, by the way. I had one of the instructors would always say, you have to wean yourself from sleep. Like as an adult, you just have to be responsible for not sleeping so much. And I think he was, you know, saying 4 or 5 hours a night was an appropriate amount. And it's like, it's unmanly to need more than that. And so from a very young age, like in the military, I was hearing that, you know, well put together, regimented people, like in the military, you don't need sleep. Sleep's something that's like for children.
Yeah, I think that's one that I've heard yes forever, and that's you'll hear that there, and then I think I hear it most from in the work arena, right? Like up really late, getting something done, up really early for meetings or to start work or whatever it is, and you know, I'll catch up on the weekends or something, is, you know, something to that effect, as though that's how it works, right? So I've heard the same. One thing that I think is maybe not a myth, but I think that is kind of unhealthy. So you'd mentioned, and I'll pick on you. You'd mentioned that you know you're up at 4 o'clock this morning. I think sometimes people will look at that as though you're doing something maybe unnatural there, like, oh, John's up at four, and then immediately I was discussing this with my mother the other day, that sometimes, especially when you're a kid, you have an idea that everyone's life is roughly the same, and so my experience of growing up is roughly the same as my friends and all that, right? Their parents are different, maybe they have a brother or a sister or something, but it's roughly the same. And I think we still do that into adulthood. So when someone hears that you get up at 4 a.m, well, how do you do that when you know, you're up watching TV until midnight, and then you turn around and get up at four, and when no, actually what's happening is that you're setting yourself up. And I think you mentioned this a couple episodes before, you know, you start to wind down and go to bed at a certain time in order to accommodate that time of you know, 4 a.m. start time for yourself. Similarly, and I run into this with my wife and I are different in the way, like, our sleep patterns are different, and I prefer to go to bed earlier and get up earlier, and she prefers to go to bed later and get up later. And I think that as a society, sometimes we make that second, like, getting up early and getting after it, right, first thing, that's the right way to do things. And if you're the type of person that wakes up at later in the day, well, that's a problem. You must be lazy or something. And and I think that's a myth that needs to be, you know, snuffed out.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. We talked about this a little bit in the last podcast segment, where we were talking about our chronotypes and our circadian rhythms. And, you know, there are some people who are so-called larks or morning birds. I'm a lark. I do my best work between 4 a.m. and 7 a.m. So I've structured my life for that. And as you mentioned, I go to bed pretty early. So I was in bed by 8 o'clock last night, and I didn't watch TV yesterday. And I was doing an infrared sauna and workouts a couple hours before that. So I was in the middle of actively winding down from around 6:30 or so on to structure that. And I wake up and I'm excited. Like, I'm ready to go. I'm not doing it. Like, I don't use an alarm. I haven't used an alarm for years. I wake up sort of naturally at that time. What's not natural would be what you spoke to, like staying up late, pushing into the evening hours, and then waking up early so that you have this, like, I'm in the 5 a.m. club, or I'm getting after it. And that myth is like the burning the candle at both ends, which is such a horrible metaphor. I mean, it's an accurate metaphor, but like we say it almost with relish and pride. Yep, I'm working real late and I'm getting up real early. I'm burning that candle at both ends. But what do you think happens to that candle when both ends meet in the middle?
Problems, John. Problems.
We'll get into some of those problems in this conversation.
Yeah, and that's happened to me. I suspect it's happened to you, and that's why you're so interested. Mm-hmm. living the way you do. But yeah, it's unsustainable, and I certainly don't want. I wouldn't want to go back to the way I lived when I was in. Like college, say, and that's how I was operating on, you know, on very little sleep. And that's when I was considerably younger and might be able to, you know, kind of quote unquote get away with it. Mm-hmm. I saw that you'd marked down here you wanted to talk about mattress companies, and I thought that was interesting. I want to see where you have to go with that, because I have some things to say about mattresses too, and just so, like, Not just the, you know, what we have in our heads about sleep, but maybe what we're literally sleeping on and what we're being told about what needs to be so about that.
Mm-hmm. I think at least for us in the U.S., we have a conflict between how we listen to our government officials, like the National Institute of Health or the U.S. Surgeon General or maybe the CDC, versus how we look at profit-based corporations. And I think, rightly so, we have some skepticism around, you know, who's profiting, follow the money trail. And I've heard a lot of people talk about, oh, the mattress companies are pushing this idea that you need more sleep because they're gonna sell like more mattresses or better quality mattresses or something like that. That's the myth. They may be commercially profiting for sure, but they are not making up the need for sleep. This is scientifically demonstrated.
Yeah, I agree. Not that I see, I guess, I don't know. I don't watch a ton of TV, so I haven't seen mattress commercials in a long time. But I do remember years ago, a couple years ago now, when Heather and I were looking for a new mattress. Then we were knee deep in mattress advertisements and everything around that. And so I would actually argue, you know, the other way, and that I would say finding a mattress or a sleeping arrangement. I don't know. I guess if sleeping on the floor works for you, then great. But finding a sleeping arrangement that absolutely works and is going to help you get the absolute best, you know, hours of sleep that you could possibly get. Do that homework. Spend the extra money there, if that's what it means. But definitely spend the extra time in the research on that. Heather and I ended up going with a latex mattress, and that has made all the difference for us with in regards to how we sleep. We like from that end, right? There are other factors, as we'll get into, that contribute to a sleeping well or not. But that end we have covered, and I would highly, strongly urge anyone to spend the time and effort and money there.
Before I respond, George, we need to cut to an advertisement from our sponsor, Simmons. No, just kidding. yeah, I think that given that you're going to spend a third or more of your life sleeping, and given what we're going to get into today about the importance of sleep and what happens when you sleep and all of the psychological and physiological processes that are very active during your sleep time, making that investment, both in terms of the time it takes you to research and understand like what's going to work for you. You know, there's not a one-size-fits-all approach. There's a lot of different options today, but I would invest in quality, invest in something that's going to last, and invest in something that's going to create the least problem for you. There's a number of things that we're going to be solving for to optimize sleep, and you don't want to have like a low-quality mattress or low-quality pillow kind of at the source of that or part of that equation. That's an easy one that you can solve for.
Yeah, yeah.
I've got another myth that I've heard a lot was, I can sleep when I'm dead. Have you heard that?
I mean, I guess you will. I guess that's true. but yes, I have. Yes, I have. I have heard that.
It fits into what we talked about in the last episode around not taking breaks. I think it's the same myth of psychology that I'm just going to push through, work for a full hour or work for 2 or 3 hours straight without a break, or work all day without a break, versus the wisdom of stopping, taking a time to rest, taking a time to regroup, letting your brain kind of relax and release, and then coming back. You have to do that on a macro level every night with sleep. And I think if people could get a sense of the difference in terms of their consciousness, in terms of the clarity of thought and energy, when they're not exhausted, when they're not sleep deprived, they would immediately understand. If you could give people a taste of what it's like to be well rested, it would be a major game changer, and they would do anything they could to have that on a permanent basis.
I agree, and I wonder if that's not a the I'll sleep when I'm dead mentality is not a sometimes I know I have kind of gotten my priorities out of order, and when I treat everything as though it's an emergency, then sleep can quickly kind of fall down the priority list, right? And so that comes in last, and in a way, it's the easiest to kind of push off, right? I can push back my bedtime pretty easily. It doesn't take any, I don't have to do anything to do that. And it's something that you won't deal with the ramifications, like a hangover. You won't deal with the ramifications of that until the next day. So I'll push through. And whatever I'm working on right now is of the utmost importance, of course, and I can kick everything else down the road. And so it's kind of easy to do that. So I get where that comes from. And it takes something to keep sleep prioritized as it ought to be. If depending on what game you're playing, right? If you're playing, I want to live a long time and I want to be healthy and I want to have live a certain type of lifestyle, then it necessarily needs to be pretty high up the list.
Mm-hmm. I think it's a brilliant point that you make, that people just do not understand the fundamental nature of sleep. If you think about all of the things that typically get shuffled out to the bottom of the priority list, whether it's I've got my exercise or workout for the day, the time it's going to take to create a healthy diet or eat whole foods or whatever that looks like, takes a little bit more time to prepare and, you know, consume that versus fast food. And sleep, again, it's that, that's the easiest thing, like you said, to X off the list. But if people could become aware of both the sort of the positive that they're missing and the negative that they're accruing, I think it would make a difference. So part of what we're going to do today, we can't give people the experience of what a great night's sleep, or even better, having an entire 30 days straight of 7 to 8 hours of sleep or more, what that feels like. But we will talk a little bit about the impact of sleep deprivation. Part of the reason this is so invisible is everybody's doing it. It's super societally and culturally accepted and almost endorsed to be sleep deprived. It goes right along with being busy. If you walk up to somebody in society today and you say, "How are you doing?" and they say, "I'm peaceful, I'm rested, and I'm not up to anything," you kind of think they're like a hobo, or they're not contributing to society in some way. What we expect and what we kind of want to hear is, "I'm exhausted, I'm burnt out, and I'm like super busy."
Yeah. Yes. Yes. Very common. And that is, you're right, that is the being busy, that is the quote unquote, that is the correct answer. Right?
I heard somebody talk about it like, if you walk outside and you've got 104 degree fever and you've got the flu and you're hungover, and you walk up to somebody else and you're like, "I've got 104 degree fever and I've got the flu and I'm hungover," and they're like, "Oh, no problem, I also have that." And then everybody you meet is walking around in that state. It's not going to occur as odd to you. But being sleep deprived is odd. It is absolutely a violation of the principles of peak performance and absolutely a violation of flow.
Yeah, and it used to, like, I would go too far off the rails, but this used to not be even possible, right? It wouldn't be possible to be terribly productive at all before we had lights, and how would one stay up until midnight or 1 a.m. unless there was an emergency situation? Because I guess maybe you might be having a real good chat by candlelight, but we have that option now. You can leave the TV on as long as you want, or leave your phone on, or the light on, for that matter, as long as you want. So, yeah, it makes it easy to kind of fall into, you know, what you're describing there.
I don't think it's too far afield at all, George. I think, you know, within the last 100 years, we have systematically eradicated what 3.4 million years of evolution have created for us in terms of the way that we eat food, the timing of how we live and where we are in our day, our relationship to light at different times of the day, and when and how we sleep. With the invention of electricity and everybody, you know, having cheap, accessible light, that is the number one cause of why we're having such a sleep epidemic. What a lot of experts think is the number one health epidemic in our world right now is a lack of sleep, and it absolutely is related to the light bulb and light.
And how does that, I know we kind of also want, we also wanted to talk a little bit about what that, how that manifests then, in how we walk around, like as far as our mood, as far as our, memory and reaction time, and right? So how does that show up? I know from an athletic standpoint, when I'm thinking about I know that I have a heavy workload coming up as far as training in like the following day, sleep becomes of utmost importance, because I know that I'll be expending that energy. And I think it's easier to think about it in those terms, like, okay, I have a certain distance that I want to cover, or a certain workout effort that I want to put out, so I know that I need sleep. And we don't always think of maybe work or our relationships or other things in quite the same terms. Like, I don't know how many miles I want to cover in my job today or something like that, right? It's we don't necessarily think of it, but we have those same those same heavy lifts that happen every day. We have big projects and meetings and important conversations that need to happen. And we need to be as well rested for those things as we do for more obvious things like a physical endeavor, I mm-hmm. would say.
Yeah, I mean, since we're talking about flow states in this podcast, the most common occurrence of flow happens across humanity at work. It happens with people having conversations with each other at work, or it happens when you're focused in on a work project, and all of that extra productivity and innovation and creativity has to be fueled from somewhere. And so you're right, we don't often look at how is our energy being curated and cultivated. And if we could get a sense for some of the negative impacts of being sleep impaired chronically, things like how your judgment is diminished, how your mood is greatly diminished, how your reaction time is slower, memory is worse, cognition is worse. Learning and learning outcomes are all accomplished at night. You think that you're learning when you're going through, like listening to this podcast, you think you might learn something. You actually won't learn it until the evening. That's when you're sleeping, is when your brain actually processes the things and puts it into long-term memory. So there are a tremendous amount of activities that are happening to your body and to your mind while you're sleeping. When we joked around about maybe you'll sleep when you're dead, no, you won't. You'll be dead when you're dead. Right now, when you're sleeping, it is as active a state as when you're awake. It's a state of consciousness, just like flow, and sleep is a high-performance state where you're processing things, you're improving memory, you're clearing out and processing things from the day, you're making connections with the things that you've learned, and that's where the learning actually sticks. So let's talk a little bit about some of like the statistics that we see for being chronically sleep deprived. And I would say chronically sleep deprived would be you're getting, you know, less than 7 hours a night. If you're getting like 6 or 5 hours of sleep a night, I've heard 5 hours of sleep is the cognitive equivalent of having 4 beers when you wake up. If you're getting 6, you're still about 2 beers. You know, so the goal here is to get, you know, close to 8 or 9 hours of sleep as you can. 7 being what I would say is like a bare minimum. But some of the stats that we talked about coming out of Johns Hopkins and Berkeley and King's College, number one, you have a 200% more higher likelihood of having a heart attack. You have a 200% higher likelihood of cancer, of type 2 diabetes. You have 50% higher incidence of obesity, heart disease, and stroke, and a 33% increased risk of dementia. The symptoms of long-term, we're talking weeks and months, not years, sleep deprivation are similar to schizophrenia. You're actually doing damage to your brain, and getting 7 hours of sleep a night versus 8 leads to a 3 to 5 year reduction in overall lifespan.
It shows up. Sleep deprivation is it's almost like the new smoking. It doesn't show up right away, right? You could smoke a pack of cigarettes a day for a long, long, long time, and it doesn't show up like day to day. You know, you don't actually feel good, but it doesn't hit until, you know, you're in your 50s or 60s or something, and then all of a sudden, you know, it catches up. Those years of of damage catch up. That's how it shows up for me. It's just like, yeah, that's just like the new thing. Yeah, I don't get sleep, and it's no problem because it's kind of like you could have one cigarette, you know, if you had like 4 or 5 cigarettes a year, that probably wouldn't do any damage. But when you're doing that day in and day out, day in and day out, takes a toll. But it doesn't show up every day, so we ignore it.
It's totally sub-perceptual. Like, you get so used to operating with impaired decision-making and suboptimal cognition and suboptimal memory that it occurs as the new normal. I love what you said about it's like cigarette smoking, because cigarette smoking now, when you see somebody smoking a cigarette these days, at least here in the United States, you're kind of like, ooh, gross. Like, that's really not socially acceptable anymore. But I think sleep will be that way, you know, maybe 50 years in the future. I think with some of the wearable technology and some of the networked homes, I think we'll start to see, like, I use the Oura Ring, to track my sleep. I think we'll start to see this connecting to lighting systems in the house. I think we'll see it connecting to thermostat systems in the house to start working in conjunction with your cortisol levels, your insulin levels, and your melatonin levels throughout the day to create the optimal environments for sleep. So I'm bullish that as a society, we're going to figure this out. But for right now, where we're at, I'm really passionate about people understanding both what it's costing them every day. Because, yes, by the time you're 50 or 60, you're going to pay for it. But you pay for it the next day. You pay for it right now. You're living life at like 50%. If you're not sleeping, you're not living passionately. You're not thriving. You're just kind of surviving.
Yeah, I think the analogy sticks. All right, in the same way, I guess if you're smoking, you're really limited on what you could do physically, for example, day to day, never mind long term. And I think you point to something good there, John, about how maybe, 50, 60 years when we have kind of the information at our fingertips a little more readily, what happened with smoking? Yes, it is unhealthy, but we'd known that for years. But what really happened is it became uncool. Like you pointed to it, right? Like you see somebody smoking. Well, that doesn't seem okay. That doesn't seem right. But it used to be really cool thing to do. I think the gamification that we see around like a lot of athletic pursuits, I think if when we start to see that, and we're starting to see it already, like people will report on like their Whoop scores or their HRV scores or things like that, like we're rolling in that direction, and I think when we start to see it and people start talking about how their sleep scores or in kind of a cool way, then we might start to see this fixed on a societal scale rather than just on kind of nerdy chats between you and me.
I'm super excited about that because I think that the technology is there. It's still kind of in the earlier adoption stages, but as that becomes more mainstream and more commonplace, I think people will be like hashtagging their HRV readiness scores. They will be hashtagging their sleep scores and saying what the sleep efficiency and sleep latency, and I got this many, I got an hour and a half of REM sleep and I got 2 hours of deep sleep last night. What about you? I think that will become associated with peak performance. You'll start to see competitively the people who are actually prioritizing sleep. This is the story of the tortoise and the hare, right? The tortoise is going to win that race every time. So the people who are prioritizing that are going to kick their asses. Not just that, they're going to have a lot more fun along the way. Life is going to be a grand adventure rather than a real, real struggle. One of my teachers told me that if you're not getting 8 hours of sleep a day, you shouldn't do any personal development work. You shouldn't get coaching. You shouldn't go to seminars. That the equivalent of going from 6 hours to 8 hours is like 20 years of personal development work. Like it just, the positive benefit cannot be overstated. So we've talked a lot about what goes wrong in the body and in the mind, and we've talked about what might be possible and where we might be going as a society. What suggestions or best practices do you and I have that we can share with listeners so that they could actually get started right now?
Well, I think easiest place to start is setting up a wake up time and a go to bed time. So I think both the studies that we've looked at would show, and anecdotally what would show up for us personally, is that setting up that routine so that your body's very used to going to bed at a certain time and very used to waking up at a certain time, like you pointed to. You do not use an alarm, which I would assert probably most people do. That's step one.
Yeah. I think maybe even for me, because I coach on this so often, I think having mindset kind of tuning first is helpful. Because I just want to say, like, I get that people might be frustrated around this topic. I get that they might be stopped around this topic, and they might not understand like how to get from point A to point Z. And I would say, you know, be compassionate, be patient with yourself, and allow progress to be iterative. You don't have to boil the ocean. All the things that George and I are about to say as best practices, they may not be appropriate or reasonable for you in this moment, but maybe pick one or two of them and just start taking it on, start prioritizing the importance of this. In terms of mindset, I would just say, like, think that it's possible. That would be the first thing, is to just expand your understanding or your idea of what's possible with regard to your sleep. Believe that you can get 8 or 9 hours of sleep a night, despite what that might look like in terms of your changes to your lifestyle. The second is, we talked last time about locus of control, and I would say developing and cultivating an internal locus of control when it comes to your sleep and sleep hygiene. For those listeners not familiar with locus of control, the idea is that you just assert that you're in charge of it, you're in control of your sleep, versus just coming from that you're a victim of it, and that you know, because of your job, because of the fluorescent light outside your window, because of XYZ, you can't. The locus of control isn't about whether it's empirically true or scientifically validatable. It's a psychological stand that you take that gives you access to greater actions and greater power. So I like starting with the mindset.
I'm okay with that. I'm okay with that. What came up for me there, I was thinking about something else that I've not experienced, but I definitely hear about is, for folks that have maybe just had a kid, how do I get 8 or 9 hours of sleep in a row? And I would have to acknowledge that it's not always possible, and I don't want to come off, I don't want us to come off as overly preachy about the subject. It is undoubtedly not always possible, but what we are pointing to around the mindset and believing it's possible, and about setting sleep times and all the different things that we talked about so far, is that ideally, when you can control your controllables, this is how you would go about sleeping. That said, have to acknowledge that there are things that come up that might make this harder at certain times.
Yeah, for sure, and I appreciate the nod to people with young children, or, you know, in family situations, or if you even just sleeping with my wife in the same bed, that presents its share of challenges from a sleep perspective. And to go back to mindset, if you start with all of the obstacles first, you really won't get off the ground. And so I just want people to, like, really believe that it's possible and work towards it as an ideal, something that you can start making progress towards. It's just like anything else we're going to talk about on this podcast. It would be like not eating sugar in our society. It's not easy, but that doesn't mean it's a good idea to eat sugar. Sugar's a toxic, addictive chemical. It's not a food, right? Overwork and not honoring agile science and deep work blocks and all of the things that we know, and being hyper distracted. Is it easy to not have a Facebook account? No, that's not easy. It doesn't mean that having a Facebook account and being endlessly distracted by social media isn't having a major impact on your life. So a lot of these things fall in the category of being simple, but challenging. They're simple to grasp. So our job is to share the science and share the best practice, and then offer some practical ways to kind of get started.
So what's the formula then for, like, what's the ABC of a good night's sleep?
For me, I would say the output or outcome rather that you're shooting for is 8 to 9 hours. And so let's shoot for 8, which means you need to be in bed by 9 for 9 hours. You need to be in bed for 9 hours to get 8 hours. So you've already hit on it. The first thing is the sleep time. So if you know, generally people are going to reverse engineer from what time they have to wake up. So let's say you're going to wake up at 6 o'clock in the morning. That means you need to be in bed by 9 o'clock to get 9 hours in bed, which means you'll get 8 hours of sleep. So then the next thing people have to do is they have to clock that 9 o'clock is going to be my in bed time. And then I recommend something I learned from Brendon Burchard, which is not highly scientific, but it's a good basic ABC kind of formula. It's called the 3-2-1. So working backwards from the 9 o'clock sleep time, 1 hour before, no screens. So that means no television, no computer, no iPhone, no iPad, no devices at all. 2 hours before, no food. So that would be at 7 o'clock, you've completed your eating for the night. And then at 3 hours before, no work or no exercise. You need to have about 30 minutes of exercise a day, moderate exercise, moderate to vigorous. So you want to have that prior to 6 o'clock. You want to complete your work for the day by 6 o'clock. If people honor that, kind of reverse engineered back to their in-bed time, that's a huge, huge first step.
I think that's great. I think that any formulaic way you can go about approaching a good night's sleep is awesome, and that's and I've played with Brendon Burchard's recommendation, and it works specifically. I really like the eating window and the screen window, but the work window too. Having your mind start to wind down and relax is imperative. And so the more you can get away from working on really hard problems right before bed, or because you're kind of used, there is a tendency to stir up anxiety late into the day, and it just doesn't flow well into it doesn't set you up for that, you know, in bed at nine and or whatever time that you land on, and flowing into a nice night's sleep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and these are all in the world of control your controllables, as you've mentioned a few times, George. Whether people can control the actual amount of sleep they get or what quality of sleep they get, they're absolutely in control of what time they go to bed, when they turn the TV off, when they let go of work. Recognize that it's going to be potentially like a big lifestyle impact. So will going to bed earlier and turning off the TV earlier and eating earlier, will that impact your social life and your leisure time? Yeah, it will. But not as much as diabetes and cancer and obesity and exhaustion. That's having a much, much bigger impact. So
a couple other things I wanted to bring up. I became very curious in kind of these I don't know, sleepscape, what your bedroom looks like. And I know or my wife and I have we've done a number of things to kind of make it so that the area that we sleep is right for us. And so I use an eye mask when I sleep to keep the light down. That's pretty critical. We don't want really a lot of any unnatural light getting in while we're sleeping, and that is absolutely increase my sleep quality. We have a separate heating and cooling unit in our bedroom so that we can keep the bedroom at a comfortable temperature while we're sleeping. We talked about the mattress already, so finding a good mattress to sleep on, that was critical. And then two more things. We sleep we will go to sleep with we actually used a Buddhist reading, like as we're nodding off, and that's very helpful for us. That kind of puts us into a very relaxed state, kind of in that last hour, like we talked about when you get in bed. So kind of we set ourselves up nicely that way. And then last thing I'll say, and this is still kind of an experiment, I would say, in progress, but we've been using a heavy blanket for the last month and a half, and I'll have more to say about this probably down the road, but so far that has really worked for us too, as far as kind of creating a comfortable cocoon environment to sleep in. We've enjoyed that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we use a 30-pound heavy blanket. We really like that. The eye mask is a really great tip. The basic premise is you want cold and dark, like a cave, like Paleolithic humans. You want to have as dark as it can be, and The temperature is around 65 degrees Fahrenheit or 18 degrees Celsius is the ideal for a human body. That's colder than a lot of people like to sleep, but that actually will help you sleep better. That's scientifically demonstrated. The problem, like just using eye masks alone isn't sufficient because you have photoreceptor cells in your skin. And they've done studies where they actually like completely covered a human as they were sleeping and put a thin LED light coming out of a fiber optic cable behind someone's knee. And that just small amount of light exposure on the skin was actually enough to stop melatonin production in the middle of the sleep cycle and start to increase cortisol, which has you arouse and wake up. A lot of this is about how you're dealing with your hormones of cortisol and melatonin, all that's produced endogenously or inside your system without having to take anything like caffeine or a melatonin pill. So blackout windows, putting tape over LEDs, getting digital clocks out or turning them away, anything you can do to just reduce the amount of light that's coming in. That light toxicity is the number one thing that's hurting people's sleep.
I forgot about blackout curtains, but yeah, we've done that as well, and that's phenomenal. And these are probably all things, especially I guess maybe for folks that work odd shifts, they might know a lot of these tricks already. But I think it's important for us people who don't, who are kind of working quote unquote regular work schedule, to adopt these as well.
I'd say just some other things that I would recommend would be a white noise machine. Having a little bit of white noise in the background has been shown both scientifically and for me anecdotally to make a big difference in terms of sleep. Don't use melatonin over the counter. Don't take sleep aids. If you're stuck in a cycle of using sleep aids, it's something you'll have to work with a professional to help get you off of, but don't lean on herbal remedies or specifically melatonin, because you will mess up and disrupt your natural circadian biological rhythm. And this whole point of peak performance is working with your biology, not against it. To that end, limit caffeine. You know, maybe 2 cups of coffee a day max, and don't have caffeine at all in any form after noon. That's for a lot of people, that'll be a big one. For me, when I have my morning coffee, I wait 35 to 45 minutes from waking for what's called the cortisol surge. When you wake up, your body will produce a rush of cortisol, which is actually really good, and it helps wake you up. If you have caffeine prior to that surge hitting, which is usually about 30 minutes after you open your eyes, you'll blunt your cortisol surge, and then you'll get more cortisol when you don't want it. So there's things that we're doing that is hampering and dampening the effects of melatonin on the one end, on the sleep side, and then cortisol on the other side, on the arousal side. So no alcohol at night would be another thing. I know that's, for some people, that's a little harder than others, but alcohol can help people fall asleep, but it robs you of REM sleep. You just never go into the REM or deep sleep cycles. Yeah, I think that's it. Those are the things I would say, is allow your body's endogenous hormones to control your sleep cycles rather than relying on things that you ingest.
I agree with what you said, John. The only thing I would add there, and this circles back to the eating window. I know Heather and I've cut out any sort of anything with sugar in it late in the day too, and that is that's helped our sleep. That's helped our sleep. That's helped us get to sleep. And that's helped our sleep quality as well.
There's an undeniable connection between refined carbohydrates, specifically sugar, and high starchy foods and sleep issues. So you'll start to see that your diet, your movement and exercise, and your sleep are not separate physiological concerns. This is all one equation. You're one biological unit. And so, cutting out sugar completely would be a major best practice and a help for most people. Having more fat in your diet, maybe counterintuitively for some, will be a huge help in terms of being able to go to sleep and stay asleep. And then at the end of the day, all of this is about having a massive amount of available energy, being an optimal human. That's the whole point of flow consciousness, right? Is to have that optimal experience of what it is to be alive and to be human, to be happy and fulfilled, have a meaningful life, contribute, make a difference, be of service. So putting sleep as the foundational element is the first rung of that particular ladder. And yeah, I just appreciate having the conversation with you about this today.
Yeah. Do we want to go ahead and get into some recommendations for everybody? So they can get this on the court and put it into action today.
Yeah. I mean, I would think honestly, all of the things we just said are things that people can start to incorporate. But if I had to say what's one, like the one thing is set a sleep time, set a consistent sleep time. Number one question I get asked is that the same for weekends? Yes. Yes, it is. So pick a sleep time, structure your life around it so that you get that you have at least the opportunity set to get good sleep. That would be the first starting point I would work with.
I agree with that. I think if you have to take one thing away, set your sleep time. And what I would add to that is don't be swayed by what you think that should be. Listen to as best you can, right? There are certain maybe constraints if you have to start work or something like that at a certain time, but listen to your body as much as you can around that. So if you are someone that works best if you wake up very early in the morning, then do that and set up your sleep times that way. And if you don't, then set up your sleep times a different way. But the important part is that it all adds up to, like we talked about, 8 to 9 hours of sleep.
Yeah, really, really good point. Early birds, larks, only represent a certain percentage of the population. Those are not automatically your peak performers or your most productive members of society. If you're a night owl, no problem. Go to bed at 2 o'clock, but make sure that you've got your day set up to start at 10 or 11 o'clock in the morning and that you've structured it to work for you.
In your coaching, what do you think, what's the biggest obstacle that you see for people around sleep?
I think it goes back to putting themselves to bed. You know, it's funny, I joke around with some of my clients because they're all adults. I coach adults, but like bedtime still to adults in their 70s represents like the hardest challenge that a lot of people have in their pursuit of peak performance. So active recovery and sleep is a grit skill. It requires persistence in no small part because the willpower that you need to do that in some cases as you're just starting is greatly diminished by the end of the day, which coincides to when you're going to be sleeping. So I think the biggest obstacle is people just choosing and saying, okay, I'm going to go ahead and put myself in the bedroom at this time. So that would be, again, that's the biggest obstacle and that's the place that I would start.
Yeah. Yeah. I like that. And what I'll say around that is, I think to circle back to my analogy earlier, kind of in the same way that it would be very hard to quit smoking if you're spouse or significant other was also a smoker and blew smoke in your face or something like that, or it would be hard to quit drinking if everybody else that you were living with was drinking or something like that. The more that you could enroll the other members of your household in this, that's going to make things a lot easier because then you become a team of people that are all expert sleepers, and then it becomes a fun game. Maybe it's not society wide, but it becomes a game that you play. It just in the four walls of your home, and that's going to increase your chances of having the stick. And that's, I know my wife and I, like my wife and I are both very much on the same page around this. And I know John, you know, you and your wife are as well. And that makes it a heck of a lot easier.
My 76-year-old mom lives with us, as you know, for the last year and probably for the remainder of her life. And she's into it as well. Like we all talk about how much sleep we're getting, the quality of sleep. My mom checks her heart rate variability every morning. She's checking her blood pressure. We're looking at different heart rate metrics, and it's all related to sleep. So in our family, in this house, we're very much proud of how much sleep we're getting. It's that's the badge of honor, not how little sleep we're getting. So it's a beautiful point. Any tech or gadgets that you like or recommend?
I'll recommend two things because one of them I already recommended, but the sleep mask for me, mm-hmm. While not exactly cutting edge technology, has been a game changer. I'm on my second one. I would say around that, if you're interested in going that route, invest in something with a good material. So I use one that has like silk that is actually on my face, and it's more comfortable. It won't irritate your skin the same way that like a something really cheap would. And then the second thing, I don't use earplugs all the time, but if I'm sleeping in say like I'm at a hotel or an Airbnb, or even like if I'm staying with my parents or something like that, when I go visit them, I use an eye mask and I'll use earplugs because I'm or I'll at least bring them, because I'm not sure what the, sometimes there's nice white noise and sometimes you're in a hotel by the highway or whatever it is, and so that way you can keep that part of your sleep environment consistent. So those are two things I would recommend.
The two tech that I would recommend, I've mentioned the Oura Ring. This has been a real game changer for me. For $300, this is a piece of wearable tech. I wear it as my wedding ring now. It's a nice, attractive ring, and it's got little sensors that connect to my Bluetooth phone, and it gives me very, very detailed information on my sleep, including my sleep latency, how long it takes me to fall asleep, how much REM sleep I'm getting, how much light sleep I'm getting, what the deep sleep levels are. For me, what was most interesting is the restlessness. It tracks gyroscopically as I'm moving and tossing and turning at night, and I've been able to experiment with different kinds of interventions and see what's made a difference. And the weighted blanket is one thing that made a real difference in reducing the amount of tossing and turning that I'm doing. I still haven't completely decoded that. There's still more to figure out, and that's what I'm working on, is my growth edge. But the Oura Ring made that kind of telemetry possible. The other thing is I really like blue light blocking glasses. And so if I do have to look at a screen after, let's say, 6 o'clock, I use the brand called Swanies. They're pretty cheap. You can get them on Amazon. They're very effective. It shuts out about 70 to 80% of the blue light that affects melatonin production. So it's a good, inexpensive way to, if you do have to get inundated with some light, to protect yourself so that you can sleep better. And you get to look like a Bono from U2.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And I would say that's especially critical, I would say, if you... One thing is, with all that we're talking about, it might be hard to do everything all at the same time. So if you find yourself, okay, I want to maybe start getting into bed earlier, but I'm not really ready to give up screens just yet, then something like blue light blocking glasses would be great, because it makes that a little more it makes it so that if you're on your phone or something like that, if you read on a tablet or whatever it is in bed, you're still able to get to sleep like you want to. So it'll kind of help you in your journey towards better sleep.
One last resource that I wanted to share with our listeners is the definitive book on this topic is Why We Sleep by Matthew Walker. He's a scientist, researcher, and doctor. Wonderful book. A lot of the research that we've talked about is coming from his studies. So that's a great book if readers want to go a little bit deeper.
And one thing that I recommend is really more of I would say an area of study. I talked about this already, but my wife and I use a latex mattress, and that's not something that we knew was even an option until we really started to go down the road of until we really started to research that area. And so I think for a lot of folks, if your idea of a bed is, I go onto Casper's website and they drop off a mattress at my front door, which isn't to say that, I mean, that could absolutely work for you. However, there are other options out there, and it's not necessarily that. It's not necessarily going to, big mattress store or something like that, and you don't need to get something with diamond dust or inside of it or whatever the... John's laughing, which you can't see, but that is actually a mattress that we were presented with at a mattress store. Diamond dust is supposed to keep the temperature, regulate the temperature of the mattress, and it actually made sense. But we're not diamond dust people. So anyway, research. I would strongly recommend researching the different options out there. And just like you wouldn't, you know, maybe buy a pair of jeans or something like that without trying it on, like, it seems goofy, but get in and lay on the mattress and see if you can like it, and use the sleeping position that you actually use and all that before you potentially spend thousands of dollars on something that you're going to spend 8 to 9 hours a day on.
Well, we were originally looking to do this particular podcast episode as a short episode of 15 or 20 minutes, and it's just such an important foundational topic. So I appreciate everybody hanging in with us as we had a chance to fully explore this. We are still just scratching the surface, so we hope that this serves you and that this helps contribute to a better night's sleep and a whole lifestyle that's based on having more sleep, more rest, and all of the benefits that occur when you do that. George, thank you.
Thank you, John. Talk to you soon.